Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the next hour or so. It's great to have you with me. Thanks so much for taking some time to listen to Tectonic. I've got a great show for you today. And I know I say that a lot at the beginning of shows, and it's always true, and it's definitely true today. I'm really excited to share this interview that I have for you. I spoke with Kirk Pearson, who is out in the Bay Area. He runs an outfit called Dogbotic, which we're going to talk about, that teaches people how to make these homemade audio gizmos out of circuits and circuit boards and resistors and capacitors and things. And Kirk has a new book out that I really recommend. If you're at all interested in this, this is a great book. It's called Electronic Music from Scratch, which we're going to be talking about in this interview here in a couple of minutes. If you heard the show last week, I spoke to Chris Pelletieri and his student about stone carving. And one thing that Chris said about stone carving that I took away, really a thoughtful idea, is that it's really important for us to be able to make things by hand. And Chris talked about the importance of the human hand as this unique appendage among all animals that we have, and dogs and lemurs and things don't have hands in the way that we do. And this interview today with Kirk Pearson, I feel like, picks right up on that theme, that it's so important for us to be able to make things by hand. And here Kirk is showing us a way to do it in the same way that Chris Pelletieri was talking about that last week. So I'm going to play this interview here with Kirk Pearson to talk about this new book. If you are interested in joining the live listening community with comments and so on, you can go to wfmu.org and click playlists and comments to see links to Kirk and the book and Dogbotic and things. Go to tectonic.fm, tectonic.fm, and find the show with Kirk Pearson on it and click the playlist link, and you can get all of the details for what we're going to be talking about. Let's go ahead now and listen to my interview with Kirk Pearson here on Tectonic. Kirk Pearson, welcome to Tectonic.
Hey, thank you for having me.
I want to say, first off, I'm really impressed with your book. It's called Electronic Music from Scratch. It teaches readers how to build, as the subtitle says, homegrown audio gizmos with step-by-step instructions and colorful cartoons and full-color photographs, along with very friendly explanations of circuitry and voltage and all of that. So nice work on the book, Kirk.
Oh, thank you so much.
We should also acknowledge that the foreword to the book was written by a friend of WFMU, Brian DeWan. He's an accomplished artist and performer who's also built his own homegrown audio gizmos, so that was a good fit.
It was kind of ideal. I never had the opportunity to meet DeWan over the years, despite knowing about his work for a good two decades or so. But yeah, fortunately, Make was able to make that happen. I could not be more proud to have a foreword by Brian DeWan.
And we should give credit to Make also. What was Make's involvement in the book?
Oh, yeah. So Make, who publishes Make Magazine, runs the Maker Faire and all that stuff. We'd been doing these virtual classes for about 5 years now, where we teach people how to build, homemade electronic instruments. And Make actually approached us. They were really lovely to work with, unlike pretty much any other person who was commissioning a thing from me. Make really kind of, they just gave us, carte blanche. We got to write the book we really wanted to write. And to go on all sorts of interesting, weird rabbit holes that probably a lot of other publishers wouldn't want us to go down.
Well, good on Make for doing that, because your personality really shines through in the book. There are frequent flashes of humor. I think I laughed out loud a few times reading some of your comments.
Oh, wow.
Which you wouldn't expect initially if you don't know about the book, thinking about a book with lots of circuitry and electronics. But you're also, we'll get into later, you're also giving your philosophy behind the making of some of these gizmos and instruments. But before we get to that, I wanted to start with an easy example from the book. Again, this is from Electronic Music from Scratch. The very first experiment in the book is what you call the world's simplest speaker, which shows step-by-step how to make an audio speaker using a paper plate and a few other things. For those listeners who want to try this at home, what materials do people need to have on hand in order to make the world's simplest speaker?
This is a great thing to do because you don't really need very much to do it. The caveat is the world's simplest speaker is also possibly the world's worst speaker, but you know, it gives you the idea how it works, which I think is the most important.
But you said it was the simplest, not the best.
It was the simplest, exactly. So to make a speaker, it's really kind of comically simple. You get a big long coil of, you know, enameled wire or something like that, and you can tape that onto a paper plate. And now that you have this big loop of wire, all you got to do is you got to put a little tiny permanent magnet in that big circle. So you have two magnets on either side of the plate. So it's really quite straightforward. All a speaker does is it takes a voltage signal, right? And it sends that through a big coil of wire. And whenever current flows through a coil of wire, that coil of wire becomes a magnet. This is like one of the simplest things that they never taught me in elementary school, but really it explains how most of the technology in your house works. It's you can induct a magnetic field by having current pass through a wire. So all you got to do with this big coil of wire on your paper plate is take an audio cable and take two alligator clips, clip one of the alligator clips to the very tip of the cable and connect the other alligator clip to the sleeve of the cable. Now with these two gator clips coming off, all you got to do, take the two big ends of your big loop of wire, right? Use some sandpaper to get rid of the enamel and gator clip those two clips right onto the wire. That's it. If you pass an audio signal out of your phone or something into that big coil of wire, the coil of wire will have more magnetic pull whenever that voltage signal goes higher, and thus it'll push or pull those permanent magnets in or out. And that's the simplest way to build a speaker. And it really genuinely works. I think it's such a fun moment to do in workshops where people kind of have this, you know, starry-eyed moment where they realize that they've conjured a sound out of, you know, the dumbest materials in the world, paper and magnet.
I understand that you have a clear explanation of waveforms.
You've all seen the representation of audio that looks like, you know, like a big kind of, you know, like a squiggly line, you know, right? All that squiggly line is that's a graph of voltage over time. So that is exactly analogous to where your speaker is moving throughout time. That's all a waveform diagram is. If you look at it, you're actually seeing your speaker displacement, right? So if you look at a sine wave or something like that, you know, which is like a nice curvy wave, that just means your speaker is going out and in and out and in. That's all a waveform is. So it's really easy to do math with waveforms. You can add them, you can subtract them, you can multiply them, you can do any traditional function, right? And it comes down to that world's simplest speaker. That's all it is. A higher voltage will result in more magnetic displacement.
Listen to that enthusiasm, people.
Yeah, who gets enthusiastic about waveforms? If you do, you're the kind of person, and you should read this book.
And these workshops, this is what you do through Doug Boddick, is that right?
Yeah, that's how we make a living. Doug Boddick is, you know, we're an artistic collective. We make weird and strange sounds for weird and strange people. And in the early days of the pandemic, we started teaching these workshops where they were effectively like, you know, skill shares, where I got to teach people about the techniques that we use in our day job. And those workshops kind of ended up blossoming into their own thing. I think the 1800th person who took to take a workshop just took it last month. And the people that sign up for them tend to be amazing. I don't know how we've avoided so many horrible people, but genuinely, everyone who signs up for the workshop ends up having just such cool ideas of ways that they can take these creations. So, you know, we had a stained glass artist that made a synthesizer out of shining light through different colored glass. We just had a puppeteer who made a puppet that sang when you opened its mouth. So, you know, people make cooler stuff than I've ever made in my life through the workshop. And I'm really quite happy for that. The hope with the book is that the stuff that's in there is kind of, it's open-ended enough. So you can really kind of take a project and run with it in whatever direction you want. I think, musical electronics is just, it can fit into a lot of different contexts. And that's what's exciting to me, is to see these kind of, you know, circuits that have been around for 50, 60 years repurposed in completely new ways.
I appreciated that throughout the book, you're showing some of the examples of your workshop students' takes on some of these projects. There was a screaming horse or something, a little horse puppet.
Oh, yeah. Anna's wonderful. She's an artist from North Carolina, took a workshop a couple years ago. But yeah, she also made a puppet, a screaming horse puppet, which is it's photoresistor controlled. So inside the mouth of this hand puppet, there's a little resistor that's light sensitive, right? So when the mouth opens up and light goes across the inside of the mouth, the pitch of the oscillator changes whoop, really, really quickly. So depending on how open the mouth is, it actually works shockingly well. And it's also just such a beautifully strange and charismatic prop. So I'm really into that project.
The reason I bring up your workshops through Doug Boddick is to show listeners that these projects in the book are all tested through your instruction to real people in real situations. I feel like they've all been battle tested. These are all eminently teachable and buildable and understandable by people who would not otherwise consider themselves, you know, electronics engineers.
Right. That's important to mention, is me nor my coworker, none of us are engineers. You know, we all went to music school. My specialty is finding weird uses for strange sounds. It's really not circuitry. I think there's something that's so genuinely empowering about learning electronics, especially through, you know, the creative arts, in that at the end of the day, I want you to make a thing that you think sounds creatively fulfilling, right? Like, if we were designing, you know, I don't know, electric car braking systems, those should work every time the same way with no variation, right? And in this case, it doesn't really matter. You know, I kind of love having musical instruments around that are a little erratic and don't necessarily behave the same way every time, because, you know, it becomes a little bit more of a dialogue where you're not, you know, forcing the instrument to do something specific, but you're getting to work in concert with the instrument, kind of like a conductor in an orchestra almost.
Let's talk about some more of the projects. After some initial experiments in the book, we get my first square wave oscillator, and it's got a little trademark symbol, as though you were afraid Fisher-Price might trademark it ahead of you. So you're claiming my first square wave oscillator.
Well, yeah, I think putting a trademark symbol after anything generic is pretty freaking funny, but perhaps that's a generational thing.
So this project with the oscillator is where you introduce readers to the breadboard,
right?
Which is familiar to anyone who's built a circuit before. But for anyone not familiar with the breadboard, you reassure the readers that it's actually a very simple tool.
Yes. Breadboards are kind of nifty. They're what we use for prototyping, right? And so with a breadboard, it looks like a piece of plastic with 800 holes in it or something like that. You can effectively use a breadboard as, like, you know, your practice mat that you build an obstacle course on for electrons, you know. So you can take individual components that we talked to you about, things like, you know, resistors, capacitors, so on, and you can arrange them in a particular circuit path, right, on a breadboard. And that way you don't have to use solder, which is kind of like electrical glue. You don't have to put a lot of work into your circuit to get a, you know, a working prototype of it. Everything that we teach really is kind of on the breadboard, because my goal is to get you making sounds as quickly as possible rather than to spend, you know, weeks of time worrying about the perfect enclosure and stuff like that. But a kind of a fun aside that I always like telling people about breadboards, which I think encompasses a lot of the political attitude behind the book. We call them breadboards because back in the late 40s, early 50s, when people were, you know, learning how to do their own electronics, you would run into your parents' kitchen and you would steal the board that you used to cut bread on. And you would hammer nails into there and then twist wires around the nails, coming up with your, you know, your janky homebrew prototype. And it's important to mention that, like, this is what synthesizers were for the majority of their history, right? Like, synthesizers only very recently became a commercial product with a, you know, a price tag made by a corporation. You know, for the most part, for the most of their history, people didn't really know what synthesizers were supposed to be used for. And a lot of synthesizers really were kind of created by individuals like you or me that might not have any specific, you know, electronics training, but just done through the process of trial and error. And so I really try to lean into that. I think it's cool that, you know, working on a breadboard, you really can have a prototype that works incredibly well very quickly. But I also think it kind of helps ground the lessons in the idea that synthesizers are a folk instrument, you know, and they really have been a folk instrument for an incredibly long time. The people that made them didn't necessarily have, you know, great, you know, engineering acumens, but it's really not very necessary. You know, the whole point of this activity is to try to find sounds that are surprising to you and, you know, push your own creative work in new directions.
Yeah, as I went through the projects, I realized that you had written about synthesizers as a folk instrument early in the book, and then you get into the projects and we're building an oscillator and we're building a low pass filter and then a high pass filter and then a stereo tremolo. And it eventually dawned on me that you were leading the reader through all of the components of a synthesizer. And in fact, the final project, the capstone of the whole book, is a synthesizer, and you call it the Dogbotophone. Can you talk about this final project that you have people build?
Yeah, so this is kind of interesting. So this is not a thing that I normally do when I teach the workshop, because I, for some weird reason, I always never liked art classes when they were so prescriptive, you know, when like by the end, you will end up with a thing and it'll look like this and there's a right or wrong way to do it. So when I teach the workshops, I really try to keep it open-ended and try to encourage people to just pick their favorite bits and pieces from the things that we've built and combine them into, you know, your own thing that you created the only version of. And I think that works great for a lot of people because everyone has different interests, but it didn't work great for this book. We finally got to the end of the book, which explains how to make like 50 tiny modules that can all, they can all work with each other. Right. But Make was like, oh, you should really have like a boss chapter that has absolutely everything in one giant machine. And so Sean, my coworker, developed one. It's kind of a beautiful instrument. The Dogbotophone, it is a synthesizer, but it's one that composes for itself. So it actually, it has two different like melody generators, basically. And the melody generators are creating their own melodies based on a couple chips that we have there. And this is nothing digital. There's no code or anything here. It's literally just like counters resetting other counters, resetting other counters. And they're able to do so in a way where they don't play any quote unquote wrong notes, you know, because they're all being derived. So it's kind of amazing when you put it together, like, it sounds so much more complex than you think it would be, right? Because you realize when you deal with these chips that, yeah, they're basically things that are counting up to five over and over. You know, they're not doing anything individually that's that crazy. But you start to realize the complexity when it comes together. So it has these two different, it has like a bass and a melody generator that can kind of write a little counterpoint with each other. And then it also has a full percussion section. So we have a version of it's kind of like a TR-808, the classic drum machine. A thing that I love of talking about drum machines, which a lot of people don't realize, is that prior to the mid-1980s, all drum machines, they weren't recording based. Like when you heard a drum machine play a kick drum, you weren't hearing a recording of a kick drum. You were hearing a circuit, right, that got smacked with a little dose of voltage, and the circuit kind of wiggles around in a way that sounds like a kick drum. So it actually is like you're hitting a thing, like, it, you know, it really is much more like a drum than people realize. And so we've combined, you know, a little thing that generates kicks. There's a little thing that generates hi-hat sounds. Fun fact for computer listeners out there, the way that drum machines make hi-hat sounds is through an XOR gate. It's putting a bunch of square waves into an XOR gate, and that creates a kind of sound. You know, funny. So it's all these different things tied together. So it'll produce a rhythm along with the melody as it's going around. And there are a couple of knobs that you can flip to change the variation. But it really kind of plays itself. It's very cool.
That is really cool. And I would love to have the time someday to work my way through this book and finally make my own Dogbotophone.
No, you'll get there.
But for now, Kirk, I understand that you have some of the projects either from the book or elsewhere from Dogbotic that you are going to demonstrate to us during the interview. Is there something you'd like to start off with?
Well, yeah, I can start off with this one. for our listening audience at home, you won't be able to see this. I put together this little silly thing directly before the interview, actually. This is one of the simplest circuits that you can create. If, you know, I guess, Mark, you can see it
here. What I'm seeing is a breadboard with some blue wires and some yellow wires and five buttons down the middle trough of the breadboard, and then five other what appear to be buttons.
Right. So this actually looks really not too terrible if you're looking at it, right? You see this little black box here. This is an integrated circuit. There's a little tiny thing here called a capacitor. Other than that, it's some buttons and a couple wires. You really can put this together quite quickly. So this thing here, this little integrated circuit, it's called a NAND gate. So a NAND gate, it's a basic computer part. The computer that you use at home has billions of these NAND gates in them. It's kind of like a fundamental kernel of computer architecture. And a great thing about the NAND gate is it was never intended to be a musical instrument. But if you do a couple things to it, you can make it be a musical instrument pretty quickly. So a NAND gate has two inputs and an output. And what we've done here is I've simply taken one input and one output of the NAND gate, and I've hooked them up in a little feedback path. So when something comes out of the output, it goes back into the input. And across the breadboard here, I have these five little knobs that you can twist around. All these are doing is they're changing the amount of out that flows back in. So if I turn on a sound here in my little amplifier and I press a button, you'll hear it make like a little oscillating tone, right? I can tune that note by changing how much feedback occurs. So I can play the Tectonic theme song here. Yay! You have a few more notes in there, but I only had room for five buttons.
Now, before the interview, you prepared a DIY Tectonic theme song. I think this is just genius. Before we listen to it, Kirk, did that theme song come from this breadboard assembly you have here?
Yes, it did, Mark. I quickly recorded a couple tones on it. And then I threw it in a little Logic project, did a little bit of cleanup, and that's what you're about to hear.
Okay, let's take a listen to this DIY Tectonic theme song performed by Kirk Pearson on...
I don't know what we call it.
The breadboard...
Breadboard-a-phone.
The breadboard thing. That was the Tectonic theme song performed on the breadboard assembly that you just demonstrated to us. Kirk, that was genius. And you said that it was pretty straightforward to put that together.
Yeah, I think it's really fun. Yeah, to make music with instruments that you yourself made. At the end of the day, I love musical instruments. I buy a lot of musical instruments for my own work as a composer. I really love working with them. But it's great to remember that, you know, the companies that build musical instruments, those aren't necessarily the people that get to determine what new sounds are. You know, you can build your own thing that makes a sound that other people have not heard before. And, you know, at least to me, it feels like I have much more agency, and it's just easier for me to write music with sounds that I feel some sort of ownership over.
And we're back. If you are just tuning in, you are listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host. We're a little over halfway through my interview with Kirk Pearson from Dogbotic. Kirk has come out with a new book called Electronic Music from Scratch, A Beginner's Guide to Homegrown Audio Gizmos. It's published by Make, and I recommend it. I think you can tell I'm pretty excited about everything I'm learning from Kirk and hearing from these audio gizmos. We're going to hear a little bit more in the second half of the interview. I just wanted to point out that the Tectonic theme song that Kirk just played on this, what did he call it, the breadboardophone, is pictured on the playlist. If you go to tectonic.fm, tectonic.fm, you will see a photo of that breadboardophone. Well worth taking a look. Let's go ahead and listen to the rest of my interview now with Kirk Pearson here on Tectonic. Let's talk about this a bit, because you write both at the very beginning of the book and at the end about the importance of building your own musical instruments. You write that, quote, creating your own instruments is an amazingly symbolic act. And then later, building your own electronic instrument can be a really empowering experience. So what are some of the transformations that you've seen as you've taught workshops, as people have learned and internalized this skill and put it into practice to build their own instruments for the first time?
The great part about teaching art, I've found, is that I don't really have to justify why the thing exists. You know, I feel like for a lot of students, you know, I don't have to tell them, and here's how you would use this musically. People can figure out what they want to say with it. I think it's empowering because it's at least growing up, I kind of felt like all of this technical stuff was really just outside of my purview as an artist. And it was really kind of wonderful to learn that it absolutely is. Like this stuff, I really believe anyone can learn how to do. It's a little finicky, you know, and things don't always work perfectly. Just like any hobby that's worth taking up, you know, you're not going to get instant gratification out of it. That being said, like when you build your first circuit that makes a sound, you really do feel like a superhuman. It's really kind of amazing. And I do think it is symbolic too, in a way that I'm sure you would agree with, which is just, you know, we don't build things. Tech companies don't build things to be understood. They don't build things to be understood. They don't build things to be taken apart or repaired or anything, right? Everything is built to be disposed so you can buy a new one, you know? So actually learning how to build a piece of musical electronics is kind of a radical act in a lot of ways, you know? And more broadly, you kind of get to redefine what a musical instrument is and also who a musician is. The act of building your own instrument really does challenge all of those basic assumptions in a way that isn't trivial.
Right. You write that corporations that fabricate products would like us to believe their goods are mythically complicated. And that rings true. I mean, if you look at recent iPhones, hasn't Apple started actually gluing some of the components to the chassis so that you can't remove it even if you want to?
Yeah, that's and that's nothing new too. I used to do a demonstration with workshops that where I would take apart one of these old Speak and Spells from the late 70s, which are really built to be repaired. They're very easy to repair. And then I take apart an Amazon Alexa or something like that, and I show you, you know, not only are the parts much smaller, but you need a proprietary seven-sided screwdriver to open up the chassis or something like that. Like, you know, it becomes very, it doesn't sound like a conspiracy theory once you start to take some of this stuff apart and you realize, oh yeah, this is deliberately designed to get you to throw it out.
Yeah, and Cory Doctorow, who's a past guest on the show, has written about how taking apart some devices actually leaves you liable to a copyright violation.
Isn't that crazy?
It is crazy. And so I agree with you, as you write in the book, that this kind of creativity, learning these skills, is a political act. And in my opinion, the politics that you're advocating, I very much agree with, is one of resistance to the centralized power of the tech industry that wants to exploit us and, as you say, turn everything into a disposable piece of waste. As far as I'm concerned, people can route around that and just take all of their surveillance devices directly to the e-waste facility and dispense with them there, and then come home, read your book, and start building their own electronics.
Oh, wouldn't that be great? Well, yeah, great thing. A breadboarded synthesizer is not going to steal your health information and sell it to the highest bidder 5 years from now. So you can be reassured there.
Well, Kirk, before we go on to my next set of questions, is there another device that you'd like to demonstrate for us?
Sure. I can show you. This one's particularly cartoonish. So a lot of what Dogbotic does is we actually do music and sound for hire. So people hire us to, you know, make a new sound that people haven't heard before for, you know, film or TV or whatever. But this one project, we were actually, we built this for a band called Vansire. They're a little dream pop band. And we call this the ringy dingy thingy. It's this giant wooden box that has these six hands coming off the top of it. And each of those hands has a little bell. And when you turn on the device, you can actually control each individual bell, and you can change the rhythm that it plays. So it produces this kind of amazing, tintinnabulous creation that the band plays along with live. And here's just a little example of this.
Now, Kirk, if someone was going to go out and buy the components to build mm-hmm. their own ringy-dingy instrument, about how much would it cost to buy all of them?
Well, weirdly enough, the actual electronics of this project, the one sitting right behind me, those aren't the expensive part. The expensive part is getting the big thing of wood, getting all the hands, getting all the bells. Putting together the electronics part is actually really quite cheap. The kind of great thing about putting together this curriculum is that so many of these components, like, they really have been in production since the late 60s. So they're all pretty easy to find, and they're all pretty easy to explain how they work. But yeah, I think the most expensive part here, each integrated circuit is maybe 20 cents. So maybe it's like $6-$7 worth of electronics and maybe $150 to $200 in boxes and hands. But some corporations would charge you thousands of dollars for a hand ringing bell machine, but no,
it's the hands, it's the plastic hands. Is there some way we can cut costs on the hands?
Yeah, we got these from IKEA. Actually, we didn't even intend this thing to have hands on it, but we found them reduced for quick sale, and we decided that would make an excellent whimsical addition.
Well, that's a great piece of work. I want to talk now about something that you brought up earlier, which was, what is a musician? Because this is something else that you write about in the book.
Yeah.
Some of the varying opinions about what musicians do or maybe don't do, what counts as music or not when you're using technology.
Right.
Near the beginning of the book, you write, quote, "One thing all musical technology has in common, people are skeptical of it." And you point out that people tend to say things like, all electronic musicians do on stage is push buttons. And you're arguing in favor of the musicians, that not only might they have built this instrument that they're playing on stage, but that they do have human agency, and it is right. Music just like any other kind of instrument. Can you say more about that?
I think that's... It's a really fascinating thing to think about. The idea that, like, yeah, a DJ is just pressing buttons, that's very much the environment that I kind of grew up in the early aughts or so. Nowadays, though, I think it would be much harder to say that. But I recall in high school, it's 15 years ago, wasn't that long ago, when people were telling me, oh, you want to be a professional composer? You need to learn how to play the keyboard. And that was just kind of assumed. That's what a composer had to do. Nowadays, I think you could easily make the case that you don't have to know how to play any traditional instrument and you could still be a composer. But I wouldn't refute that, you know.
And you pointed out something I didn't know, because I used to play the piano. And you mm-hmm. said when the piano first came out, there was skepticism around that instrument.
Yeah, and right, the joy of that is you can take that all the way back to, you know, some caveman carving flutes and someone going, "Eh, you didn't, it's not the human voice," you know, or whatever. Like, you know, people are always skeptical of a new thing that makes sound because they think in some way this new thing is taking away human agency. And so I do think it's really important to kind of keep that in mind. I think music technology broadly, it's, yeah, you're coming up with a musical use for a thing that isn't obviously musical. And, you know, that is just as true for if you're building pianos or you're building, you know, digital code, I guess, that's writing music or something like that. I think music technology as a term is really only effective at communicating one thing, and that is discouraging people from saying they're participating, you know. prior to the steam engine, you know, everyone was an engineer, right? And then all of a sudden we had a term to define the people that did it the right way versus the not right way. And, you know, music, I just don't think that designation really exists.
But of course, in the last couple of years, we have seen the rise of another technology that does throw a lot of this into question. And that is, of course, generative AI. And I thought you had a nice turn of phrase. You write, "Generative AI is a tool designed for legitimizing plagiarism that extrudes cultural byproducts like a tube squeezes toothpaste." And that
I think that's a Mark Hurst quote almost.
Yes.
You use extrude a lot, which is a great term for generative AI.
That's exactly how I feel about it. I mean, you just squeeze the toothpaste, as you say, and it just, you know, comes, just squishes out of the tube. And that to me is categorically different from what we were saying about, you know, the flute caveman and the piano player and now the DJ who's doing things on stage. Generative AI is a totally different class of object. How do you see it, Kirk?
I wish I had a better answer, because I mean, I've been thinking about this a lot. You know, I think I do feel like generative AI is different than, you know, the drum machine, right? Like, I don't know, having pre-programmed drums didn't make drummers obsolete or something like that. So I do try to keep that in perspective, that, you know, we shouldn't necessarily fear the tool. That being said, I have worked as a professional musician for quite some time, and I understand how producers work. And I gotta say, I played around a little bit with Suno last week, and I am actually pretty worried for my own ability to keep doing my job. I feel like for a lot of music, you know, like the Chapel Roans of the world, they're not going anywhere, right? But for a lot of the job that me and a lot of my peers make their living on, which is, you know, writing effectively music that goes in the background to fit the context of something else, I kind of worry that those days are over. So, you know, culture is going to win. I don't know what form it's going to take, but culture fortunately always wins. We're going to find, you know, we're going to find our way out of this somehow. But it does make me sad that generative AI just seems to be adding to a big pile of mediocre culture. And the worst part is I don't know if the general populace really cares, you know, like that's the thing that scares me. I don't know if people really care if they're listening to AI generated music or not.
Well, that's what Spotify is banking on, and we'll see if they succeed. In the meantime, you finished the book with some very helpful and informative appendices. There's a glossary and there's a description of electronics terms. But I was also really impressed that you put in two appendices on music recommendations. One has 10 pieces of electronic music everybody should know. And the other lists, as you put it, 70 great synthesizer albums. So
yeah,
this I thought was a great way to punctuate the end of this book, to say, not only can you build your own synthesizer, but here are pointers to dive into the work of synthesizer musicians in the past. Is there one favorite synthesizer piece or album that you really want to highlight?
So I really loved the writing the list of albums, because I think it's nice for people to know that their work is, you know, it's in conversation with work that's already existed. There are a lot of synthesizer pieces that have, you know, they were written 60, 70 years ago, but they're still inherently kind of about this friction between humans and machines. And synthesizer music that's made today kind of also has that inherent moral to it as well. That's the commentary that they're making. So pieces of music written, you know, 70 years apart, despite the fact that they're not literally, you know, alluding to the same technologies or something like that, are ultimately having a conversation across the decades. And I think that's just a wonderful thing.
It is. And I have enjoyed listening to some of the music that you pointed to. On that note, by the way, where can listeners learn more about you and the book and Dogbotic and maybe even hear some of the audio that comes out of these amazing machines?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Well, we're on all the social medias as Dogbotic, Instagram, Tumblr, TikTok, Grindr. You'll find us. We're also dogbotic.com is our website. So we do a whole bunch of different things. You can hear our work, you know, the kind of commercial work we do. We built a whole bunch of synthesizers for Rihanna like 2 years ago for her use in a fashion show. And so you can see stuff like that. But yeah, we also have a whole bunch of resources, projects that you can do, workshops that you can sign up for and stuff like that. Really, we're just trying to be an outlet for people to pick up, you know, oft maligned creative skills that they might not have learned in art school, you know. And also we kind of hope to be, you know, a bit of an antidote to try to learning electronics online. You know, learning engineering online is really kind of cold and unfriendly. You're going to be shamed by people you don't know for knowing things that you shouldn't necessarily know anyway. And, you know, we want to give some people some assurance that the engineering world doesn't have to be that cold and unfriendly, that this is really, it's really doable. And it's really quite fun, you know, if you have the right person introduce it to you.
Well, I found this book informative and entertaining, but also maybe most importantly, I found your book inspiring, which is not something that I expected from a book that was teaching how to build these homemade musical gizmos. But it's true. You, Kirk, are showing us that there is good in technology and it can be good and helpful and positive for the world to embrace technology in this way. To learn how to build it and modify it and be creative with it. The book is called Electronic Music from Scratch, A Beginner's Guide to Homegrown Audio Gizmos by my guest today, Kirk Pearson from Dogbotic. Kirk, thanks so much for being on Tectonic today.
It was a sincere pleasure. Thank you so much, Mark.
And we're back. If you are just tuning in, you are listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the remaining several minutes of the show. We just heard my interview with Kirk Pearson, author of a new book called Electronic Music from Scratch, A Beginner's Guide to Homegrown Audio Gizmos. It's published by Make, just came out. We also heard about Kirk's involvement with Dogbotic, the team, the movement, the community that Kirk runs out there in the Bay Area, teaching people how to build these homegrown audio gizmos, both through the book and through workshops and Dogbotic does its own work with Rihanna and other artists, as Kirk mentioned. Just what passion, what enthusiasm for one's work and the ability to get other people excited about something like building circuits is just so impressive. And that comes through in this book. So again, Electronic Music from Scratch. I also want to thank Kirk for showing up on the playlist and offering some comments and answering some questions to listeners during the show. I have, as I mentioned before, I have posted links to Kirk and the book on the playlist, which you can get to at tectonic.fm. That's tectonic.fm. And there is also on that playlist a photo of the what I'll go ahead and call the breadboardophone, which played Kirk's DIY Tectonic theme song, which, by the way, that was a truncated version, a slightly truncated version of the theme song. I'm going to use the full Tectonic DIY theme song as our outro this evening. So stay tuned to the end of the show when I'm going to play the full-length file from Kirk. Kirk, by the way, points out that there was quite a bit of editing. It wasn't just off of the breadboardophone. There was some editing, of course, that took place afterwards. But what mastery of the tools to be able to build a breadboard instrument and run this homemade theme song through some processing for a little bit and come out with such a beautiful rendition of the song, a really new creation. I was so impressed. I was also impressed. I just want to say that this interview, this book, what Kirk is doing, this whole show fits into this theme that I'm trying to develop a little bit as we go through the weeks and the months here on Tectonic, that tech can be good. And I have plenty to say about the bad news still emanating from the big tech companies in Silicon Valley. And I plan to have an upcoming show to give you an update on some of those headlines. But I don't want this show merely to be a weekly dose of grim and depressing news. First of all, because I don't want everyone to get all bummed out, and me either. But also because that's only half or maybe a lot less than half of the story. The real story around technology is that it can be liberating. It can be creative. It can be helpful. It can be all of these positive things if you have people like Kirk Pearson showing us how to create and build and design and use and employ this technology for good in the world. And so I feel so privileged to have this show in order to try to put some spotlight on good people and good projects and good communities out there that are showing us that technology can be good. And so I'm really happy to be able to present this interview to you today, because that fits that ongoing theme, and I want to do more shows with that theme. And I'm not going to go too far in that direction. Try to turn this into an only good news show, because I think it is important for us to understand the real risks that we run due to the unethical dealings of a handful of billionaires and their toxic sludge factories in Northern California and Washington State, and now increasingly based more and more in Washington, D.C., which I'm not going to say more about just yet. But let me come back to the good theme here. That the good one aspect, this isn't an exhaustive list, but one aspect that really resonated with me in Kirk's work is that these creating your own audio gizmo puts the power and the autonomy and the agency and the creative possibilities in your hands. I mean, literally, as Chris Pelletieri would have told us last week, in your hands. So important that it's manually done. It's in your hands, this power. And yes, as Kirk mentioned in the interview, there is no instant gratification. You have to learn a skill. You have to learn what circuits do, and you have to learn what the components do. What is a resistor? What is a capacitor? And so on. And that's all covered in this book. But it does take some time and effort and experimentation. You make some mistakes along the way, and maybe there are happy accidents, and that turns you into towards a new direction to learn something even cooler. Who knows? But it takes some time. It takes a commitment, in other words. And this is so interesting to me that this came up in this interview with Kirk, because the exact opposite of this philosophy of putting creativity in the hands of people to make their own use of technology, the exact opposite of that was voiced on last week's show by the co-founder of Suno. And you can go back, go to tectonic.fm, tectonic.fm, and listen to that show with Chris Pelletieri about stone carving, because I played this this excerpt from this podcast of the Suno, this AI-generated extruded musical product company, talking about why he, the Suno co-founder, thought it was so great for people to be able to make music, what he called music, by pressing a button on a screen, or pressing the button on the mouse to say, you know, extrude, go ahead and extrude this musical product for me. And what this guy said was, he's excited about his product because, as he put it, people don't want to learn skills anymore. They don't want to learn an instrument. They don't want to make the commitment to learn how to play music on their own because it's too hard, it takes time and effort and so on. And I thought that was such a cynical and ridiculous argument to make, that we're in an age where people only want push buttons. I mean, come on. Obviously, push buttons are helpful for some things. It is good for us to have a button to push in order to do some task of drudgery or danger, as we talked about. But when it comes to something really meaningful, like learning a skill to play playing music is one of the most beautiful and meaningful things a human being can do. And so it's always a worthwhile thing to put in the time to learn to play music, whether through an instrument or through a homemade audio gizmo that you learn about through Kurt Pearson's work. And so I thought it was really important that Kirk wrote this book. And there's a quote I want to read to you, because it so perfectly encapsulates what I believe, and what I'm hoping you believe as the listeners as well to this show, Tectonic, that we stand for good tech, for good people doing good things in the world. And here's what Kirk writes. Every piece of electronic music, just through the act of calling it music, makes a statement on what music is and can be. It makes a statement on who or what a musician is and who in that present moment has the privilege of being called a musician. And later Kirk goes on to write, building your own electronic instrument can be a really empowering experience. With surprisingly little upfront learning, you'll have the godlike ability to conjure new sounds out of nowhere, sounds that no preset can make. Better yet, you'll have the knowledge that unless someone else has constructed a circuit exactly like yours, with the exact nuances of the parts you grabbed and stuck together, you'll have the world's only copy of that synthesizer. And that's really cool. And I totally agree with that. And we can make that same argument, not just in homemade audio gizmos, and not just in learning the guitar, the piano, or the theremin, or whatever, but in any worthwhile skill that you want to build, whether it uses digital technology or not. But that includes digital technology, too, if you're doing it in that way. So thank you again to Kirk Pearson for being on the show today. And friends, I hope you enjoyed that interview. Speaking of the theremin, I just wanted to bring up that here at WFMU, we have an upcoming event on Friday, January 31st at 8 p.m. downstairs at Monty Hall, 43 Montgomery here in Jersey City. The event is called The Art of Playing the Theremin with Doric Chrysler. This is an event hosted by our own DJ Trouble. All proceeds from the event benefit WFMU and the New York Theremin Society. And in this event, you're going to learn how to play the theremin. Doric Chrysler is going to guide you through tips and tricks during the workshop, and including calibration, positioning, exercises, and no touching. No touching the theremin. It works fine without touching it. So please come out to that Friday, January 31st at 8 p.m. Details at wfmu.org. Friends, that's about all the time I have this evening. As I said, we're going to go out to Kirk Pearson's DIY version of the Tectonic theme song. Until next time, friends, I have some homework for you. I want you to avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google. Stay tuned for Dave Mandel, who's not a vandal, but he is back. Happy to see him. And you are listening to the greatest radio station of the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. And if we have time after the Tectonic theme song, we're going to hear a little bit of Raymond Scott from Soothing Sounds for Baby, Volume 2, which is one of the albums that Kirk recommends at the end of the book. Have a great week, everybody.
And welcome, everybody, to another exciting installment of It's Complicated, an hour of prog and prog-adjacent music, whether you like it or not. I'm your host, Dave Mandel, back from a short respite from the show. And before I forget, I want to heap many thank yous on Erwin Chusid, who filled in for me last week and did a superb show. I listened to it. Thank you, Erwin. And we're going to start tonight's show with some music from the Netherlands, the NL, as they call it out there. It's going to be a group called Finch. Where is it? It was here a minute ago. There it is. A group called Finch from the early, mid-70s. And we're going to hear a track from an album called Galleons of Passion. What can I say about this? They were obvious Yes influence, I guess, the band Yes. You'll hear in the bass and drums, I believe. And this is Finch. Thank you.